Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
Welcome. It's 6 minutes past four in the Mountain West. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. We're going to have a lot of fun, I predict, this hour. My guest is Dan Peterson, and Dan is speaking at the FAIR conference in Salt Lake. I think you're speaking on Thursday. Is that correct, Dan?
No, I'm actually speaking on Friday, I think, at 4 o'clock.
Oh, Friday at 4 o'clock. Okay. Yeah. I apologize for the mistake.
The conference goes Thursday and Friday.
Very good. And why don't you, before we get into the topic at hand, why don't you explain what the conference is about and where people can go to get tickets?
Okay. It's FAIR is the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. That's what the letters stand for. And it's put on a conference every year now for, I don't know how many years it's been, easily 15, I would think, maybe more than that. We're all getting so old. But it tries to deal with issues that raise controversy for Latter-day Saints, with challenges to the faith and so on, and to provide faith-promoting answers, things that can help people deal with questions, with doubts, with objections. And so every year we've done this conference, and for the last, many years, most of its history now, we've been meeting at the Southtown Convention Center there in Sandy. And I think now pre-registration is closed, but tickets can always be bought at the desk when people come in if they want to attend a single day or part of a day or both days.
And this is going to be a feast.
Yeah.
Telephone number 254-5855. Now, Carl, if you happen to be listening, I'd like you to call in right away. I usually get fed up fairly early in the conversation, but I will be more generous with the time, Carl. Here's your opportunity to just fire away and issue all of the challenges that you want to issue. And anyone else out there, I'm very serious about this. If you are, if you consider yourself either to be a Mormon protagonist or antagonist, or if you think that those of us who are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are somehow deluded and we've been conned into believing something that isn't true, I want you to call. I really do. And normally we don't encourage attacks on the church at all. But here is an opportunity because we've got someone who is used to dealing with this and can help all of us. And let me give you one of Carl's favorite lines. He's said this on two or three occasions when we've had guests. There isn't a shred of archaeological evidence to indicate that the Book of Mormon is based on fact.
You know, I kind of lose patience with that kind of claim. I can understand somebody saying there's not enough evidence to convince me, or, you know, there's not enough evidence to prove the Book of Mormon true. But to say there's not a shred of evidence, oh, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. I mean, and we could go on this for hours. The rough correlation, for example, of the dates in the Book of Mormon of the Nephite population and the Jaredite population that's earlier with what we now know about the Maya and the earlier Olmec civilizations. They arise at the right times, they disappear at the right times, or decline at the right times in the right areas. If you buy John Sorensen's geographical model, which I tend to, then even that alone, I mean, we didn't even know the Olmecs existed when the Book of Mormon, but they correspond very nicely in some ways to the Jaredites. And then, to me, one of the more impressive finds is actually an Old World find. I'm an Arabist by professional training. And that's the place called Nehem in the Arabian Peninsula, where we now know that name Nehem, essentially the same name, goes back to the very time of Lehi. And if you go due east from that, as the Book of Mormon peoples do, you arrive at the one place on the Arabian Sea coast where you have all the conditions that are fit for the Book of Mormon's Old World Bountiful. You know, a sheltered bay, wood, fresh water, a place where you could build a boat and live for a while. And Joseph Smith is very unlikely to have known that.
Well, I put out the call for Carl, and he's been kind enough to join us.
Okay.
So, Carl, ask away.
I'm not a professional, since no one pays me. You know, I do all this on my own. But let me start off with when Joseph Smith was writing the Book of Mormon, he lost the 116 pages the first time to Martin Harris. He knew he could not rewrite those 116 pages in the same manner as he had the first time, and he didn't know if these pages had been destroyed or whether they were in existence. You know, he had to take the chance that they may still exist, so he could not take the chance of rewriting that 116 pages. I want to ask you, why did not an angel of God tell him where those 116 pages were and whether they existed or not?
Well, you know, I think you've constructed a nice narrative there, which I don't buy. As to why God or an angel does this or that, I can't always answer that, because God and angels don't necessarily think the way I do. There are a lot of things where I'd ask, why didn't God intervene here? Why didn't, you know, why did God allow Stalin to grow to maturity and kill hundreds, or not hundreds, but scores of millions of people, God seems to intervene to help somebody find their lost car keys?
Well,
I can't answer that question.
Well, why didn't Joseph Smith, pray to God and say, tell me if the 116 pages are destroyed or whether they exist?
Actually, God prepared something in advance, more or less anticipating that this happened, correct,
Dan? Right,
Ann?
Yeah, there's an excuse for everything.
But let me go back to the story you're telling. What you're saying is that Joseph had made this all up, the 116 manuscript pages, off the top of his head, and that he knew he couldn't go back then and redo that. Now, that's what I find implausible. So you're sketching a scenario that I don't find believable. Joseph Smith dictated the Book of Mormon, we now know, at a rate of about 8.5 to 11 of the printed pages in the current edition, day in, day out. Now, if you ask me to believe that he just dictated the Book of Mormon in the space of about 2 months, off the top of his head, which is what your scenario presupposes, then I find that in and of itself unbelievable. I don't find your presupposition believable. I couldn't do that. I can't write a book 11 pages printed day in, day out, without any revisions. I just can't do that.
Okay,
if you rule that out, then, if you say, well, but he was reading from a pre-existing manuscript, then your question disappears. Because then he did have a manuscript, and he could have redone it easily.
No, I'm not saying he had a manuscript.
I'm saying your scenario that he didn't doesn't work.
Okay, let me ask you. How long did it take him to write the first 116 pages that were lost?
We don't know exactly, but we have a very good sense of how long it took the rest of the Book of Mormon. That's about 8.5 to 11 pages of dictated text per day.
Well, didn't it take him as long as the 116 lost pages, as long as when he rewrote the book?
Well, are you saying,
suggesting
that he just dictated this thing off the top of his head? Is that what you're saying?
The first 116 pages, he was getting in shape for, the rest of the book.
Suddenly he took off and could dictate 11 pages printed material a day. I couldn't do that.
I'm still talking of the first 116 pages.
I know, but I'm saying I don't believe your scenario.
Well, how long did it take? Approximately. How many months?
You must know. Tell me.
Well, no, I don't know. I have an idea, but you probably have a specific answer.
I don't have a specific answer. I haven't looked into that question specifically. I do know in the text that we have now that it averaged between 8.5 and 11 pages in the printed edition daily. I know nothing to suggest that Joseph was really, really slow And then all of a sudden, miraculously, with no extra education, he could suddenly dictate at this incredibly rapid pace.
Okay, let's go on to my next subject. Now, in the first chapters of Nephi, they leave Jerusalem at the behest of a warning from an angel.
Yeah.
And they travel to the Red Sea. The Gulf of Aqaba would be the nearest water. It would be 155 miles as the crow flies, more if you walk. Now they arrive at the Red Sea. Then
hold that thought.
Okay.
We'll come right back. Energy.
AM 630 K-Talk. Real people. Real talk. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
424 in the Mountain West. My online guest is Dan Peterson. And the antagonist on the other line is Carl. Carl, you were saying about travel time.
All right. They leave Jerusalem, go to the Red Sea, a minimum of 155 miles. I've measured it on accurate maps. Then they decide they have to go back to Jerusalem to get some plates, the plates of Laban. Okay, they get back to Jerusalem, they've covered 310 miles. They get the plates, go back to the Red Sea, they've covered 465 miles. Then they decide they've got to get Ishmael and his family. So they go back to Jerusalem, they've covered 620 miles. Then they go back to the Red Sea, they've covered 775 miles, a minimum, as the crow flies. Now,
With a Maserati, that's no big deal.
Yeah, right, yeah. Why couldn't the angel at first have told them, okay, leave Jerusalem, but get the plates and get Ishmael's family. That way they'd only have to travel 155 miles. Now, 775 miles in those days was a murderous distance. Joseph Smith was just making this up as he went along. I think he had a general idea of the story he was going to write, but a lot of the details he just made up at the last minute, like this one.
Our friends, who haven't just looked at a map, they've actually walked those distances. You can think of someone like Jeff Chadwick at BYU, who's spent a great deal of his academic career, his professional career, over in Jerusalem. He's actually walked several of the possible routes. We don't know the exact route that Nephi walked or the Lehi walked, but we can guess, and we have a pretty good sense.
Okay.
And, are you sure that they're all the way down by the Red Sea?
I'm talking about the Gulf of Aqaba. That is the nearest water.
It joins
with the Red Sea.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, and this is a straight-line distance, which they would not do if they were walking or riding horses. This is the way the crow flies. And they didn't have air transportation in those days, did they?
I don't know. Did they?
Maybe on the back of an angel. If you can believe the rest of the story, I guess you could believe they flew on the wings of an angel. All right. How about we go on?
Wait. When it said that he goes down to the wilderness near the Red Sea, where exactly is he? Do you know?
No, I don't know. And neither did Joseph Smith.
Well, wait a minute.
Do you know?
No, I don't know. I have some idea. We have identified some places down there that fit where he was. Places that fit the description, for example, very, very nicely. Are you aware of that?
Well, yeah, I'm sure sand and sea describe a lot of places, and you can...
you're not aware of that, right?
Don't lose your place in this, but I want to pitch in just one little thing. About 40-some-odd years ago, when I took my family to Israel, they showed us a place called Lehi that was named after Lehi. And, by the way, the translation of the name, as I recall, means jawbone of an ass. But it's a present caller notwithstanding.
So your point being?
My point being that there are documented evidences of the place names and the people's names in that area. Go ahead, Dan.
So doesn't the word Lehi appear in the Bible anyway?
It does.
Yeah, okay. That's where Joseph Smith probably got it.
Well, you know, you've got a lot of probables here.
Well, you don't know either.
You say that that sand describes a lot in that area. Yeah, it does. But when they get into an area and they find a river there and it's flowing, and Lehi talks about the valley being immovable and all that sort of thing, what kind of valley are we talking about? Do you know? Is it just flat sand?
Well, how many valleys are there in the Middle East?
Well, I actually know because I traveled the area fairly frequently, including a few weeks ago.
Every time, let him answer, Carl.
Wait a minute.
He asked me.
Wait a minute. There is a valley there that fits in a very spectacular way. A river runs through it. There are granite walls, sheer cliffs on either side. It's the right distance from Jerusalem. It seems to fit exactly the kind of valley that he's describing.
In your opinion,
if you think that area is nothing but sand, you're wrong.
Well, there's vegetation.
Have you been there?
Does the Book of Mormon describe the exact vegetation that's there?
Have you been there?
No, and I'm not going to go there.
Okay, well, I have, and I've been in some of these valleys, and they fit the description. Does it describe the exact vegetation? No. But it describes the exact appearance of the valley. When he talks about an immovable valley, what does he mean by that? What could be more likely to be that than this valley that's right in the right location with sheer granite cliffs on either side? It's like a slot canyon in the Zion area.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of documentaries taken from a helicopter or a plane that pretty much describe what you're saying anyway. I mean, it could be anywhere.
But no, it could not be anywhere. There's a specific valley with a river that runs toward the Red Sea that has granite cliffs on either side, and that fits that description perfectly, and there are no other places.
Carl, excuse me, what type of helicopter did Joseph Smith have access to?
That was my next question.
Right, yeah. Well, who knows? He may have as well have been describing his backyard. You know,
except his backyard didn't have cliffs going up on either side, and it wasn't near the Red Sea.
Isn't it true when he went to visit his wife down there across the Pennsylvania border, there was a Lehi River there? Isn't it possible he also got the name Lehi off the river?
You know, any number of things are possible, but this fits the Middle East precisely.
Well, the fact is, no Hebrew, Israelite, Christian civilization has ever been discovered in Mesoamerica, in North America, in South America, in any of the Americas.
So you're shifting and abandoning that criticism and going to a new one.
Oh, no. Mills was talking about, the things I say, and I'm asking you, have you ever discovered a city in the Americas that are proven through Hebrew or Egyptian writing, through Israelite pottery, through Israelite weapons, that this is where the Israelites, also known as Nephites, were?
What would an Israelite pot look like?
Well, I don't know.
Because there's no distinctively Israelite pot. What would an Israelite weapon look like? No way of telling, because there's no distinctively Israelite weapon.
However, Dan, isn't it a fact that they have found changed or reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics?
There are several places where people have found what looks like Semitic inscriptions in the New World.
Where?
Now, people will even Bat Creek, Tennessee, for one.
Oh, that's a phony.
It is, and some people argue it isn't.
You're talking about the Bat Creek stone. Right?
There's a Paraíba inscription in Brazil. Again, they're debated. People go back and forth on these. What I would say is you may have very exaggerated notions of what have been found in the old world. There's no question that the Israelites lived in and around the city of Jerusalem. But the first inscription that actually identified Jerusalem as Jerusalem was found only a couple of decades ago.
Where?
In Jerusalem. We've always known that it was Jerusalem, but we know that because the name survives. Now, no name in Mesoamerica really survives. That's why a lot of these sites bear Spanish names, like El Mirador and Piedras Negras and so on, because the original name is lost, and we have no inscription that identifies it except to say you know, this city was known as Two Frog, Three Cloud or something like that.
Yeah, we have the Mayan inscriptions, and they have been decoded. The Mayan language has been translated. You know, it's amazing.
And one of the experts I've had on the air several times, Carl.
Who?
Forgive me, I don't recall his name, but we'll have him back again.
What did he say?
I'm not going to try and speak for my guests.
I mean, you're trying to prove what? That the Mayan language is related to Hebrew?
No, what I'm trying to do is to say that there are experts who have translated the Mayan language, and one of those experts has been on my show.
And I talked to him.
I'm sorry?
I talked to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said he had found Lehi down there in Mesoamerica.
Well, now, I haven't, so I can't comment on that. He did.
I want to make my point. My point is that you say, well, they haven't found proof in Mesoamerica. Only recently did we find proof of an Israelite presence in Jerusalem.
Irrelevant.
No, not irrelevant at all.
Bring up irrelevancies.
Try to understand the logic here.
Stick to the subject.
Try to understand the logic. Drowning me out won't help. The logic is this. In an area that is far easier to investigate, that is, because it's not overgrown with jungles and so on, it's far more heavily investigated because there's a lot more money going into biblical archaeology than there is into Mesoamerican archaeology. We have a written text that everyone admits is historically based in that area. It tells us where things are. There is no doubt that Jerusalem is Jerusalem, and yet, archaeologically, it's only been possible to prove that Jerusalem is Jerusalem for about 20 years. Now, so yep. Then you say, well, we haven't found proof in Mesoamerica. Well, good grief. We've only found proof within living memory in Jerusalem.
Oh, no, they've been digging around in Mesoamerica for 150
years. Not nearly
years.
As much as in the biblical world.
Well, that's irrelevant.
No, it is not irrelevant.
I mean,
you think it's easy.
Tell
you
me,
think it's easy in Mesoamerica. Have you been to Mesoamerica?
No.
Have you been there?
I've seen plenty of documentaries.
Well, and no, a documentary doesn't count in this case.
I have been to Chichen Itza.
Okay, if you go down there and you walk around in the jungle, you'll recognize the archaeological conditions for research there are far, far different from what they are in the barren areas of the Middle East where no vegetation obscures ruins. Where ruins are obvious on a floodplain, you see a tell, it's an artificial hill, you know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
Where we have a living tradition, the names are still present. It's easy to find things there, yet even there, biblical sites haven't been found in many cases, including Jerusalem. There was no archaeological evidence.
Okay,
Jerusalem was Jerusalem in ancient times
until 20 years
ago.
Why in the Book of Mormon... Is jungle.
You understand the point?
Never
I want to know if you grasp the point.
He isn't interested. It's apparent in the point.
I'm beginning to realize that.
You're going off in a direction that's totally irrelevant.
No,
it is not
Carl,
totally irrelevant.
Your arguments are irrelevant because they're not based on logic. They're not based on linear thinking. But I've given you more time than I ever gave anyone else. I'm going to give you one last question. So ask your bombshell question
right now. The big lie leads to a lot of smaller lies, and to make up these stories to say we found evidence for the Book of Mormon, that's an absolute lie.
What do you think of the work of John Clark?
I don't know John Clark.
Well, John Clark is one of the leading authors on the subject, and you haven't read him?
No.
Oh, well, and so you think it's just a lie, but you haven't
read
what he's written.
Who is John Clark?
Okay.
John
Let
Clark
him
is
answer.
One of the leading Mesoamerican archaeologists in the English-speaking world. He happens to teach at BYU, and he's a leading Latter-day Saint.
So he's a Mormon.
He is a Mormon. He's
in other
also,
words,
as I say,
he found evidence to the contrary of the Book of Mormon, he would probably never state it.
I'm going to judge John Clark
not having heard
his name until today, and not having read a line that he's written, never having heard of him.
You just talked yesterday to a researcher who was eminently well qualified, and he went way out of his way to say that this scientific approach demands certain types of responses, and he refused to speculate. And now you're branding somebody else a liar that you haven't even read. Carl, you're...
Well, I, you know, you have...
You're irrelevant.
You haven't told me what John Clark says.
Well, you can read what John Clark says.
No, no,
online.
You tell me.
Do a search.
You tell me.
Go to the Maxwell Institute
no,
website.
Don't go.
Look
I'm
up
not
John
going
Clark.
There. You tell me what he states.
Have you read John Sorensen's work?
Yes, I have. An ancient,
okay, what do you think of it? What are the errors you find?
Oh, my God. You know, I. You want me to start with number one and go to number 100?
Just give an example.
Well, first of all, okay, he places the Book of Mormon scenario between Mexico City and Guatemala, an area that was inhabited by the Mayas. He looks at Mayan cities and claims they're Mormon cities. I went down to Chichen Itza, and I talked to a Mexican archaeologist there, and he made fun of the Mormon church in claiming that the Nephites had settled in that area. He laughed at the whole concept.
Okay, Carl.
I'm supposed to take seriously your account of the laughter of some unnamed Mexican archaeologist. Well, you haven't even read John Clark.
Carl, I want you to listen. I've given you more
that,
than
I thank you.
I've given you more time than anyone else, but I'm going to give you a tiny bit of I'm going to give you a specific example, so stay tuned. And Lisa, I'll be with you in just a second. Dan, you may be acquainted with Martin Tanner.
I am.
Okay, Martin, just before the show, told me something that I had not heard before that Carl should find very interesting, because we have the Mayan petroglyphs and hieroglyphs, and we also have the stories of the Book of Mormon, where it talks, for example, about warriors cutting off the limbs of their enemy and using them as trophies, something
right.
that's virtually unheard of in modern warfare, or in even historic warfare. But there, Martin told me about this one petroglyph that talked about a warrior soliciting a prostitute. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with that one.
Okay. When we come back, I'll quickly give that, and then we'll move on to other things, and we'll take Lisa's call. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk.
AM 630 K-Talk. Grab your phone and make the call. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
4:43 in the Mountain West. This is Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. My guest, Dan Peterson. Dan, I am giving this story secondhand, so I may butcher it. And if you are familiar with it, correct any errors, please. Martin told me about this one pictorial story showing this warrior soliciting the favors of a female, and in payment, he offers the arm of a slain enemy. Oh, and coincidentally, the arm is white. Now, my question to Carl to think about is, gee, where did this white enemy come from? Have you run across anything else like that, Dan?
I have seen some murals, for example, at Bonampak, at the very southern edge of Mexico on the Guatemalan border, where you see a battle between light-skinned and dark-skinned people. And I am aware, even in a modern painting on the side of one of the big buildings at the University of Mexico, there's an illustration in the big murals on the side of the buildings there of people offering arms after a battle, as proof of their conquests and the casualties they've inflicted. So that's definitely an ancient custom, and it shows up in the Book of Mormon.
And I don't think there would have been any contemporary information to that effect during Joseph Smith's time.
No, and you remember, this is not a big reader, and he's living in rural New York. I mean, some of us live near good public libraries. He did not. And there was a library there. It was tiny. We know it was in it. And it also required that you subscribe, and the Smiths never did because they had no money. So I sometimes see all these lists of books that critics of the church imagine that Joseph was devouring. His mother said that he wasn't inclined much to reading, and there's no evidence that he was.
Interesting. Lisa, thank you for your patience. You're on.
Oh, hi. Well, Carl's a trip, I can sure tell you that. To be patient as you are with him is incredible to me. But anyway, it's K-Talk. We should be able to give our opinions. When Martin Harris presented him some copy of the characters which had appeared upon the gold plates which Joseph Smith was given by Angel Moroni, when Professor Anson said, quote, "I cannot read a sealed book," remember he tore up the thing knowing that it to do with something religious, and he took the paper back saying it was the best copy of any characters he'd ever seen of the characters, the Book of Mormon. And then when he thought about when she said it was, when he said that he can't read a book that's sealed, in other words, he said, "I cannot read a sealed book." And then he didn't realize, I'm stuttering here, but I'm trying to find this quote here. "I cannot read a sealed book." He did not realize that he was literally fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah.
Right.
Which is, quote, "And the vision of all is becoming, and the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed." That's Isaiah 29:11. That's talking about the marvelous work and the wonder that come forth in the last days, which will bring forth Christ's true church again and has established it on earth in the end times before he returns. So that, let him look at that and explain next time he comes on what Isaiah was talking about, 29:11.
A mere coincidence, I'm sure.
Yes, well, anyway, you're very patient, and I will continue to listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Durrell, welcome, sir. You're on K-Talk.
Hello.
Hi.
It's great to be able to talk with Daniel Peterson and Hughes Mills.
Yes.
I'd like to just mention briefly a few evidences for the Book of Mormon before I get into early anti-Christian parallels with modern anti-Mormon parallels, if I could. We have the Lakish letters, which the script, the characters that are on these Lakish letters that were found on pottery, letters written on pottery, match up with the Anthon transcript samples of writing that's from the Book of Mormon. And then we have Demotic, which is an Egyptian good equivalent of a candidate for a type of reformed Egyptian. Metal plates have been found all over the world. And then we have the calendar round system of the Mayans, the seven manic, which matches up with the wounded god stories. It's the manic symbol looks like a chopped off hand, and it looks like it's grasping. Now, the interesting thing about that is when you consider the headband twins, the maize god, corn god's resurrection hand clasps, they match up with early Christian artworks of Christ descending to the underworld.
Any comment, Dan?
No, you know, that's fascinating stuff, and I'm glad that you're out looking at these things. You know, there's so much material out there that we need to go through, and there are things out there that we haven't begun to discover that that will come in as supportive of the Book of Mormon. So,
right.
Yeah, those are really striking. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, let's consider some early anti-Christian parallels with modern anti-Mormon writings. Dan, you wrote a book. It's called... what was the name of that book that you wrote with Professor Stephen Ricks?
It was called Offenders for a Word.
And it's a really excellent book. I recommend that. I read that years ago. And you touched a little bit into some of these parallels. Now, Carl likes to use environmental patternist theorists to say that scriptures were derived from pretext parallels of the environment that the Joseph Smith lived in. And Celsus, an early anti-Christian, basically used the same type of thing. He also rejects the pre-existent themes. He mocks that, Celsus, an early anti-Christian. He mocks the Christians for believing that Christ descended into the infernal regions and that they could become perfect. And he mocks their secrecy. He says they meet in secret and they do strange things. And he also said that God had sex with Mary to produce Jesus, that God became a man, that they couldn't make up their minds if there were three gods or one God. And so these parallels go on and on. Have you noticed that yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the techniques used by opponents of the gospel have really stayed relatively the same despite the change in technology and everything a couple of thousand years.
It's almost an argument for reincarnation. Maybe self...
yeah. Maybe, you know, the same arguments keep showing up. Maybe it's the same people. What a depressing thought.
Or maybe it's the same same spirit that caused the people to reject the early Christians in Christ. Is
or the same author.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, Darrell, and thanks for the good work in getting these guests for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
John, welcome. You're on K-Talk.
Thank you, Mills. Hey, to your guest, I really appreciate you being on here and your knowledge and insight.
Sure.
To the caller that was on two calls before me, the lady, reference scripture to convince Carl is irrelevant because Carl is not a believer either way. He will find the same things to bash in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. So referencing the Book of Isaiah to him, it's a mute point. And to Carl, I would like to ask, he said he went down to the city and the Mexican archaeologist laughed. Well, have that Mexican archaeologist explain what the heck happened to the Mayans. Where did ages go? What the heck happened to their records, supposedly the stuff they can translate? What happened to the Incas? And then if they can please explain what happened to all the records of the Aztecs, of the conquistadors, that was their first thing when they came over, was to destroy all the records of these people. And then if he can explain, and his scientific expertise, how anything could survive some of the massive earthquakes that are described in the last parts of the Book of Mormon and third and fourth Nephi, about whole cities being swallowed up and stuff, how anything could be survive, any relics could survive that would all of a sudden, just from scratching around under the dirt, they would magically appear. And his scientific knowledge, if he could explain that and expound that, I would be totally enthralled and spend hours listening to his explanation.
You just reminded me of something. Dan, you may be familiar with this. I remember seeing photographs of huge layers of volcanic ash covering cities and crops being trapped under there, so that it occurred suddenly.
Yeah. Yeah, there's reason to believe. My personal leaning is that the Book of Mormon story took place mostly in Mesoamerica, and that's an area of a great deal of volcanic and earthquake activity. Things are always happening there. And we know of a small city on the shores of Lake Atitlan in Guatemala, for example, that was submerged probably in a sudden earthquake event, probably around the time of Christ. Just suddenly dropped, or the water rose suddenly. It's hard to tell which. So that it's now down where scuba divers have to go look at it. But it happened so suddenly that things are still more or less intact in this archaeological site underwater. I mean, things like that did happen there.
Right. Well, and I believe that things, as described in the Book of Mormon, happened there.
Yeah. And one point I'd like to make, too, about archaeology, what archaeology has and hasn't discovered. Most artifacts that humans create disappear. They will never be found. They're destroyed, whatever. Even of those that aren't destroyed, they're buried or lost, they probably won't be found.
Right.
And of the ones that we find, sometimes we don't know what they are or how to interpret them.
Right.
So some people think that, if a city was ever there, we'll find it, or a building, we'll find it. Now, I have a story about that it illustrates it's not as simple as people think. Years ago, there was a group that went to upstate New York, to Palmyra, to look for the original Smith family home, the little tiny home that they lived in. Now, they knew almost exactly where it was. And it was only a couple hundred years ago, and so on. So they dug trenches. That's what archaeologists do. They don't have the money to just dig up everything. They dig exploratory trenches to see if they can find something, and if they do, then they extend the trench. Well, they dug trenches all through this area, and they couldn't find it. And they were absolutely baffled because they had the land records, something, you know, the kinds of things we never have for the ancient world, but they had it for this house from 200 years ago. They couldn't find the foundations of the house. Then they went back about 20 years later. The archaeologists who did this told me the story. And they found eventually that on every side, their trenches had missed the foundations of the house by about 3 inches. They had just failed to find it.
Wow.
And then the next
time
they did find it. So my thought is, how can you be so certain that something was there 2,000, 3,000 years ago? You're going to find it. When we can't find something from a couple hundred years ago, where we've got written descriptions of where it was.
Interesting. Mike, welcome.
Yeah, I found a really interesting website called Mormon Geography, and it described the potential place of Costa Rica as where Zarahemla was located, and the primary reasoning for this was the narrow neck of the land that he gave, it being a really, actually a very narrow strip of land between the Pacific Ocean and a lake that's down there. And the thing that I found really interesting is, you know, all the distances that the Book of Mormon lays out pretty clearly, you know, traveling from certain seas to another sea, everything could fit down there. I was just curious if you've read, I forget the author's name, and what your thoughts were on
yeah, him. I don't think I've read that one. I need to read it then. But I will say this. One thing that I think Sorensen and then other people who followed in his footsteps have demonstrated, you know, trying to put the Book of Mormon down in Mesoamerica, the distances in the Book of Mormon are small.
Yes.
People travel a few days, probably on foot, maybe on animals. You know, we're used to these big distances. We can get in a car and go 600, 700, 800 miles in a day. But they couldn't. For them, 50 miles would be an enormous journey for a day. And the Book of Mormon never includes, apart from, you know, coming over from the Old World to the New World, it never includes journeys that are more than, you know, at the most, a couple of weeks long.
Jan, we're at the top of the hour. Can you stay with us for a while?
Yeah, I can.
Excellent. Okay. Mike, if you have some more questions for Dan, I'd ask you to hold until after the news.
May I just make a super quick comment?
Very quick.
If you Google Costa Rica Mormon Geography, it'll take you right to the website. And
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
That. We'll be back with Dan Peterson right after top of the hour news. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on KTalk.
Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
6 minutes past five. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. My guest is Dan Peterson. And Dan, I don't know if this is any fun for you, but it is for me. And it's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Good to be here.
One of the things that Dan Peterson does is pointing out the typical anti-Mormon tactics, particularly in view of the fact that these are being used in a very negative campaign against Mitt Romney, who is running for the presidency of the United States.
Yeah.
And some of the most ridiculous allegations are made by people who either know nothing at all about the church or deliberately distorting. How often is it that you find in this anti-Mormon stuff absolute bull-faced lies?
Quite commonly. It's surprisingly common. I remember one of the great granddaddies of them all was the late Dr. Walter Martin from Southern California, who claimed, among other things, to have a doctorate and to be a descendant of Brigham Young. Both claims were false. He claimed in one of his books he dedicated to his mother, Maud Ainslie Martin, a descendant of Brigham Young, he said, but a disciple of Jesus Christ. Well, that was supposed to give him authority, I guess, to speak about Mormonism. But in fact, she wasn't a descendant of Brigham Young. you know, when you start making claims like that, you're kind of on Mormon territory. We know how to check genealogical records. And people checked, and it simply wasn't possible that she was a descendant of Brigham Young. So the next edition of his book said, "To my mother, Maud Ainslie Martin, a relative of Brigham Young, but a disciple of Jesus Christ." Well, relative is pretty vague. I'm a relative of Attila the Hun. I mean, you do it distant enough, we're all relatives.
Sure, if you're human.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you say you're a descendant, that's a pretty specific thing. But a relative? Well, you know, my fifth cousin seven times removed is my relative. I have no idea who he or she is, but we're relatives. We're related. You can relate any two people on the planet if you work hard enough. So, you know, there was that, and then he claimed to have a PhD. Now, I don't care whether he has or had a PhD or not. There's no sin, obviously, in not having one, but there is a sin in claiming to have one when you don't. And he claimed one, and he got it from an office, from a university that had an office about 20 feet square, and a staff of four, the title of dean, and you paid $500 and you got a doctorate. So,
wonderful.
You know, fraudulent. Just bogus. And there have been others. You know, there was one who claimed to be a descendant of Oliver Cowdery, and he wrote a book a number of years ago, and his name wasn't spelled the same way. Our Oliver Cowdery is E-R-Y, and this guy's name was R-E-Y. And he said, well, it was a family variant. But that wasn't the only problem. Here's the problem. Oliver Cowdery only had one child, and it was a girl. And she died unmarried. So if he's a descendant of Oliver Cowdery, this is a miracle.
That is an immaculate conception.
That's right.
Interesting. Caller, your first name, please. Yellow?
Hello?
Yellow caller.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Ms. Peterson a couple questions.
Yeah, your first name, please.
My name is John.
John, go right ahead.
Okay, so first of all, Joseph Smith, he made lots of prophecies. He made some of them that were arguably somewhat accurate, and he made some that were incorrect. Would you agree?
Now, I'm sorry, I had a little hard time understanding. Are you saying that he made some prophecies and some of them were correct and some were not?
Yes. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, you know, some of the prophecies that we have from Joseph are recorded third hand and so on, so I always want to know, you know, what did he say exactly, because...
Well, we have some that were recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants,
yeah.
Some in the predecessor.
Some of those. I take those more seriously than the third and fourth hand ones, yeah.
Sure. But you would agree that even some of those that were recorded, you know, turned out not to come to pass. The prophecies were not fulfilled.
Well, I think there might be a few that haven't yet been fulfilled, some where the conditions were changed, you know, where there was a conditional clause saying, if the following happens, then such and such. Well, you could argue that that the if clause wasn't fulfilled, so the prophecy becomes neutral. I mean, for example, there are prophecies of the form, if you remain faithful, then the following will occur. And, you know, then the person doesn't remain faithful, so the condition isn't fulfilled, so the prophecy doesn't come to pass.
Well, of course, but we could lay aside those that are conditional, shall we say. And there are still, nevertheless, some which were following the lines of they didn't come to pass as prophecy. For example, going to Boston and finding a treasure of silver and gold in someone's basement.
Yeah, that one didn't happen.
Okay, so as another example, if you talk about how you can possibly come up with a book as complex as the Book of Mormon, certainly not in the time frame allotted in dictating it over the space of just a few months. But would you agree that while the dictation literally took place in a shorter period of time, that the whole time that Joseph Smith was telling stories about the Native American people that we come to know as the Lamanites and the Nephites, that had been going on for several years?
Yeah, his mother tells about that in her biography of the prophet, yes. Of course, none of those sorts of details actually make it into the book.
Well, we don't know what details precisely made it into the book.
Well, she talks about giving details of their dress and their mode of transportation, neither one of which really makes it into the book. I mean, if you, there's no description in the book in any great detail apart from some things about armor, about Nephite dress. So those things don't seem to be coming from the book, and they don't go into the book. But the reason I would argue
that... not in great detail, of course. But
yeah.
My point is that it wasn't simply a matter of dictating some kind of story that was made up off the top of his head in, say, 2 to 3 months or so, when the idea potentially could have been fermenting in his mind for many years.
Well, yes and no. It seems to me that it's one thing to have an idea. It's another thing to sit down and dictate a text. And I write a lot, and I keep a record of how much I write in any given day or any given week. And, you know, here I'm often writing about subjects that I've thought about for years and years and years. You know, I've done graduate studies on them. I've thought about them, taught about them, and so on. But I can't write that rapidly, and I write pretty fast.
Okay, and I'll give you that. I mean, not everybody can. We're not suggesting that, you know, Joseph Smith was simply a very average, common individual by any means.
But what I'm saying is I write rapidly, and I don't rewrite very much. I write a lot. I'm an unusually rapid writer, and I write an enormous amount, and I find the amount of writing that Joseph would have had to have done staggering, just staggering. I've never been able to maintain anything like that pace for the 2.5 months that he took to dictate the Book of Mormon.
Mark, he made it up out of the whole plot. However, we do have some of the suggestions by such notables as B.H. Roberts that perhaps he took some inspiration from A View of the Hebrews by Ethan Smith.
Yeah, I don't see that as very convincing.
Perhaps from a different manuscript than the Spaulding manuscript that we have in hand.
Yeah, the Spaulding manuscript theory, I think, is even weaker than the Ethan Smith theory.
Well, we certainly know about the Spaulding manuscript that we do have, and I think
of course, people have hypothesized that there's a second lost manuscript, and I suppose if we found that and it didn't bear any relationship to the Book of Mormon, it'd be a claim that there was a third manuscript. There's no evidence there was a second manuscript, and you may be interested to know there have been recent studies done using word print analysis, statistical analysis on the Book of Mormon, and the Spaulding word print is totally different from the Book of Mormon.
And yet, while it is very, very different, and certainly came from different authors, there are many phrases that are found in the Spaulding manuscript that are also found in the Book of Mormon.
Well, there are phrases that are found in Cicero that are also found in the
Bible.
We're
talking specific phrases about how certain types of objects and such are described.
I don't think they're very impressive. Have you read the recent studies that have been done? I'm going to keep talking. Have you read the recent studies that have been done by Bruce Scalia and Paul Fields and Matt Roper on the Spaulding manuscript theory?
I certainly can't profess to be an expert as those gentlemen are in that field.
Well, let me recommend those.
Study currently.
Yeah, let me recommend those.
Well,
they're on the Maxwell Institute website.
John, please, one person at a time. Okay?
Let me recommend
we'll
those
listen
articles.
To you, but one person at a time. Hold, gentlemen.
Yeah.
We'll be back right after this commercial announcement. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk.
AM 630 K-Talk, the voice of Utah. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
524 in the Mountain West. You're listening to Drive Time Live. My online guest is Dan Peterson. All right, John, give Dan your very best challenge and then listen while he responds.
Okay, my very best challenge is the Book of Abraham. Let's take a look at it. We have the Census of Papyrus, which has been translated by modern Egyptologists and even church Egyptologists such as Hugh Nibley. It bears absolutely no resemblance to the Book of Abraham's story in anyone's mind except those with the absurd notion that it is some kind of mnemonic device. Basically, you have the number two, the facsimile number two, which describes, or which is described as being a hypocephalus. The description given by the prophet, apparently, of various different characters and various different items on it, again, bear no resemblance whatsoever, with the most general exception being of the bull itself, to any kind of description of what Joseph Smith gave for those various different characters. And so how do we go about explaining, then, what the translation is of the hypocephalus and the translation of the Centenpyrus and the other scraps of manuscripts that most likely are what were considered to be parts of the Book of Joseph, and yet none of these have any relation whatsoever to the Book of Abraham or to Judeo-Christian scripture as we understand it today.
Okay, you've stated the case. Now we'll get an answer. You want to listen on the air?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Thank you for the show. Thank you for the opportunity. You've been a gentleman, a scholar, and I appreciate it. And also, despite my disagreement with you, Mr. Peterson, I appreciate your patience and understanding as well.
Sure.
Thank you. And do listen on the air for the response. Look, I do want to interject one thing. Anybody who has read accounts of the original scrolls would know that the fragments that have been found are not the scrolls. Dan, how long were the scrolls? They went through a room, as I understand.
They must have been
40 or 50 feet long?
Uh-huh. The idea that we have all of the scrolls that Joseph Smith had is quite clearly untrue. And John Gee has published a lot of good stuff on this. An Egyptologist with a PhD from Yale. And John has argued that we have about 13% of the Joseph Smith papyri, and he uses several lines of evidence to argue that. First of all, measurements of typical scroll lengths and what we now have as fragments of the Joseph Smith papyri, but also descriptions that had them unfolded on the floor of the Nauvoo house and filling several rooms. What we have now would fill a corner of one little room. So it's pretty clear that there were other papyri that Joseph had that we no longer have, and they probably were destroyed, very likely in the Chicago fire. So it simply isn't true that what we have today is the Book of Abraham clearly and doesn't translate to be the Book of Abraham. Now, another thing I'd say is there are things about the Book of Abraham that are really quite striking. For example, I remember years ago, a critic who made fun of the crocodile or alligator-looking figure in facsimile 1. Well, the Book of Abraham identifies that as the idolatrous god of Pharaoh. And he said, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that's just the crocodile god Sobek. Well, the crocodile god Sobek, particularly in the so-called Egyptian Middle Kingdom, which is the period of Abraham, is specifically identified with Pharaoh. Many of the pharaohs during that period had the name, like Sebekhotep and things like that. They'd put the name of Sobek in their names. They ruled from an area called the Fayum in central Egypt, which is an oasis just off to the west of the Nile Valley. And that oasis was famous in historical ancient times for being full of crocodiles. And so the crocodile god became the god of the pharaoh. And there's even a statue, if anyone goes to the city of Luxor, in Upper Egypt, go to the little archaeological museum there, and in the foyer of the museum is a larger-than-life statue of one of the pharaohs, Amenophis IV, as I recall, and he's seated on his throne, and standing next to him is the crocodile-headed god Sobek with his arm around the pharaoh. He is the crocodile god, the patron god of Pharaoh. Now, you know, I think to myself, all right, how do you brush that one aside? Because it's not the most obvious thing in the world. Some frontier yokel like Joseph Smith comes along and sees that alligator or crocodile in that facsimile to immediately think, oh, the idolatrous god of Pharaoh. But he's exactly right. And there are other things like that in the text that are exactly right.
And to me, they represent more than just chance. That is to say, I would argue that the Book of Abraham actually is ancient. Let's leave aside for a second the question of how the text derives from the papyri. Just look at the text itself. There are lots of things in it, like the Council of the Gods and the Plain of Olishem and the various things in the facsimiles that really do tie into the ancient world. Where'd they come from? I lay that as a challenge to critics of the church. Where'd they come from, these things that are so very accurate and striking?
It's also fascinating. I listened very carefully when John said that they bear no relationship to the Book of Abraham at all. What Hugh Nibley translated is striking. It's almost shocking what it does describe, because, and I'm not going to go into specifics, but it talks very specifically about certain temple ordinances.
Yes. Yeah, it does. I remember a few years ago being over in the Temple of Luxor with a group of Latter-day Saints, donors to BYU, and so we were taking them on kind of a special tour. And we had an Egyptian tour guide with us. You have to. It's the law. So he was going to take us on his usual tour of the Temple of Luxor, which is a spectacular place. But we knew some things we wanted to see specifically. John Gee was with us, my Egyptologist friend, and he led us over right to some panels on one of the temple walls. And they were amazing. And here are all these Latter-day Saints there taking pictures. And the Egyptian guide came over to me and said, "What in the world? Why are you so interested in this?" Well, I wasn't going to tell him. But it was obvious to any Latter-day Saint looking at that, with just a little explanation of what was going on. You know, we stood there for about 10 minutes in front of those pictures, talking, or those images, talking about them, getting pictures of them, and so on, because they just blow you away when you see them.
And for those people who would like to know what we're talking about, do some research on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, repent, be baptized, pay your tithing, go to the temple, and you will say, "Oh my gosh."
Yep. Yeah, the temple to me, by the way, I'll just say, you know, along the way, the temple to me is one of the great evidences of Joseph Smith's calling. Unfortunately, it's a little hard to talk about it.
You can't.
Yeah, but I see
and
things all the time.
And it's not because it's secret, friends.
Yeah.
It isn't secret. It's sacred.
Yep. But I see things all the time in the ancient world where I think, "Shazam, look at that."
And there is, when you see these things, you think, there is no way a New York farm boy could have in any way, shape, or form ever known anything about these things.
Yeah.
No way in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark, welcome. You're on K-Talk.
Oh, hi. I have just a couple, three little comments about what you had a little bit last time before the break about Central America and that place down there.
Yep.
I think people don't follow the scriptures very close in the Book of Mormon where it describes the Book of Mormon land. They've gone off on a theory that doesn't coincide with the scriptures. Because the Niagara River is the river Sidon, and it's provable in the Book of Mormon without doubt. And the other thing is that when a white god or something came down there, this could be a whole different group of people brought it to this land, just like the Nephites, the Jaredites, the Amalekites. Because that happened completely after Book of Mormon times, and they've got a history of a white god and so forth. And when Christ left the land Bountiful, he says, "The Father has commanded me to go to the lost tribes and to those of the isles of the sea." Now, we don't know how many people he went and visited, but the time will come when we will know. Now, they found Christian relics in a Buddhist cave over in China. That doesn't mean that the Nephites were there. The original Christian religion originated with Adam, and everything else on the face of the earth is a break off from that original religion, and you're going to find pieces of it every place on this planet.
Well, I think that's fair, Dan, don't you?
Yeah, I certainly agree that there were lots of things going on in the ancient world that we don't know about. And I look forward someday, not in this life probably, but someday, to getting the full picture of everything that happened, where people went, and what people were doing. Because, as I tried to say before, most archaeological artifacts are lost. They disappear. They'll never be found. We'll never find them. And the same thing is true of most stories, most happenings. They happen, they're remembered for a generation or two, they're forgotten, and we will never know about them. We'll never know where people went, what they did, all the complexities of a history. We get a little bit. We get a small percent of what happened, and we're lucky to have that.
The other thing, what's going on right now, every word a prophet says is not revelation.
Right.
At times he'll be talking about something, and something will come into his mind, and he'll say it, and later he'll find out that after he studied it, well, that's not quite right.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, especially those against the church and against the Book of Mormon, will try to pick up on every one of these. Oh, that was revelation. Well, it isn't revelation unless the prophet says, "And thus saith the Lord."
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's his opinion based on his own studies and his own reading. And a lot of apostles who have written books and that and finally become prophets of the church have changed their opinions when they became prophets.
Well,
so
when John was
careful on what is a man's opinion and what the direct revelation is.
Yeah, when John was talking and bringing some of these issues up, I immediately thought of Jonah. And Jonah made a prophecy, and when it didn't come to pass, he was very ticked.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this happens. The Lord is in charge of the church. He's changed his own instructions during the migration of the church and the persecution. Well, this is not going to happen now because of this. It'll be postponed. That's why Christ is the leader and the Savior, and his prophets do what the Lord wants them to do, and they do change things on and off because of the conditions.
And if a prophet prophesies the destruction of a group of people and they repent, then that prophecy is no longer valid.
In the prophecy it says, if they do not repent, they will be destroyed. See, there's always... So those are neat. We need to understand.
They have to be given their free choice.
That's right.
Appreciate the call. And the
talk down to live to hear the sad results in their lives for doing it. Anybody wants to know if Joseph Smith's a prophet, they just got to get on their knees and ask. Sincerely, and they'll know. And if he's a prophet, then everything else is true.
But Mark, haven't you found that most of these people don't really want to know?
No, it's like Carl. He's against everything that comes up. And he can't document what he says.
Appreciate your call.
They're just out there to cause problems and agitation and so forth, and we find it all around us.
Thanks for the call.
We live in Babylon, which is evil.
Yeah, thanks for your call and for your comments. Fred, welcome.
Oh, I couldn't resist. Let me run a few imperatives by you. You already said that Joseph had only 3 years of formal education, and he was roughly 23 years old when he started the translation.
Yeah.
And, if you take the Book of Mormon for face value, the idioms, the chiasmus, the metaphors, the patriarchal blessings, the geography, the names, even if you don't believe ecclesiastically or religiously in the Book of Mormon, it is listed as one of the great works of literature in the world.
Yeah.
For no other reason, for its literary abilities there.
It's an astonishingly complex and rich book.
Yes. And when Joseph was translating and Oliver was there helping him as the scribe, Joseph had to stop periodically to eat, go to the bathroom, people came to the door and so on, and not once did he have to cross-check and say, "Now, Oliver, where were we?" and go back. He just started from where he was and continue on, and you don't have a lot of redundancy or any redundancy there.
Yeah.
And just to show you some geography there, now I'm trying to fit this in for my own mind. The narrow piece of land that they were talking about, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec and the river Sidon with Uno Mancita River fits perfectly that description. I don't know if you wanted to know that trivia or not, but it's true. And those are found now in Mesoamerica. And to do what he did with 3 years of formal education in roughly 65 to 70 days. Now, if he was translating, there's a neat model to follow. May I run this by you? I got a couple of things I want to...
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk.
AM 630 K-Talk, live local two-way talk. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
5:43 in the Mountain West. Welcome back. Fred, you were saying.
Yes, I just was, I forgot exactly where I was, but there's one thing I wanted to say about Joseph, that he never cross-checked, but the fact is, if you compare, they say he was translating, and I believe he was, with some Japanese scholars. They were translating, retranslating old Japanese into new Japanese, and they had over 8 scholars with all of the reference materials and so on to do that. Joseph would crank out between 8, 9, 10 pages a day, and these Japanese scholars translating from their own language, which was their own old language, to the modern language, they were feeling well-served if they could do one page a day, just to give you a comparison model. Now, one other thing here is a lot of people now go into the DNA mode. Well, because I'm a retired biologist, I like to run that by, because first of all, they use haplogroups. And these are mitochondrial DNA groupings, the markers, is found only on the Y chromosome. So it raises the question, in the number of years and centuries that have gone by with the way these so-called scholars, to show you where they're flawed in their thinking, is the fact that what if they had no children or they had all girls?
Yeah.
Then those markers would be flawed, and not only that, they had intermarrying of people there that were there besides the people of Lehi. And so that would cloud and flaw the pure haplogroup lines because there was not a continuation. It would end as soon as there were no children or only girls. And so they're flawed from the outset. And I just thought because they're using mitochondrial DNA, and any of those who are the naysayers, look it up and do your own research. Don't believe me, but I'll just say that it is listed in the Library of Congress right now as one of the most widely read books. You have to have something that's not just falling off the turnip truck to get it in the Library of Congress. And I'll just say again that, and it's listed in there because with all of the names, the places, the geography, and to put that volume, that amount, and following 3 different timelines at the same time, and that's a fact, too, try that just as a composition and have the names accurately. And so that's why it's listed as one of the great literary works, and it is. I just thought I'd throw that in for interest's sake.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate the call very much. Hi, caller, your first name, please.
Wayne.
Welcome, Wayne. You're on.
I was listening to the last guy talking about the mitochondrial DNA. There's been quite a few studies on the mitochondrial DNA of Native Americans, and they're actually showing no ancestral relationship to the the people of the Middle East.
Not true.
How much DNA research have you done, Mills? Because I've actually done it on the DNA on the Dead Sea Scrolls, where they're actually doing goat genealogies and actually determining where the dates of when the scrolls were actually written by the genealogy of the goats.
Yeah, I know the guy that's done some of that, Scott Woodward. He's a believing Latter-day Saint geneticist. If you're interested in this topic, you might be interested in a book that I edited called The Book of Mormon and DNA Research. You can look that up online. It's on Amazon. The Book of Mormon and DNA Research, edited by Daniel Peterson. But it contains writing by a number of geneticists, that is, DNA specialists. And I think you'll find it interesting. Some of the leading DNA specialists in the United States today happen, perhaps by chance, perhaps not, to be Latter-day Saints.
Tell me, Dan, am I in error? My understanding is that while the vast number of American Indians do not show any Middle Eastern ties, that there are some North American Indian tribes that do. Am I in error?
Yeah, there's one very peculiar...
Oregon and China.
There's one very peculiar DNA marker that's found that's unique to certain Indians in the American Northeast and to the Druze people in basically in Lebanon, northern Israel, and Syria. And it's really puzzling because it seems to go back to a really early time. We don't know what it means, but you know, it does seem to indicate either it's pure coincidence or some connection.
But Mills?
Yes.
There was some research done on some of the tribes in Oregon, and they actually mapped them to groups that have actually left from China.
Okay, that's not surprising, but that isn't the issue. The issue is that there are some tribes, like the Iroquois, if I remember correctly. I haven't done a lot of research in
this
area.
It's in that area. I can't remember if it's the Iroquois, but it is definitely American Northeast.
Yeah.
But you have to look at something else, other artifacts. Now, realize, I'm LDS, and I believe, okay, but they have actually found Roman coins in the Mississippi Valley Basin, okay, from period times. And that, you know, although we tend to think that Leif Erikson, you know, came over here first and then followed by Columbus a few hundred years later. But there's evidence that the Romans were here. There's evidence of possibly Egyptians, you know, with the Ra type stuff coming over here. But that could have been, so you know the genealogy and going back and you actually trace that through, it's kind of hard to say because of, we actually have documented evidence that the Romans were here in North America.
Correct.
My feeling is that ancient people got around more than we think they did, and that if we ever come to know the full story, we'll find that there were people traveling back and forth fairly frequently. John Sorensen at BYU has done a lot of work on this with, for example, plant species that seem to have been transported. We don't know the story or anything like that, but they seem to have been transported deliberately from Asia to the New World or, you know, vice versa. Indicating they were carried by humans at some really early period. So my bet is there were people going back and forth much more than we imagine.
Well, exactly. But the thing is, it's a matter of a lot of the claims that are made are kind of, to me, kind of seem rather bogus because I was one of the initial movements in the electronic genealogical industry where we actually were producing stuff that the church couldn't put out at the company that's now the forerunner of Ancestry.com.
Yeah.
And I was the first project manager of their first microfilm image ROM product, you know, like more than, you know we're talking about 20 years ago, close to 20 years ago. And actually have done DNA stuff, donated times for FARS and that in the 90s, on Dead Sea Scrolls, we're actually donating my computer software development talents.
I absolutely agree that there are a lot of bogus claims on both sides. There are those who claim that there is absolutely no DNA evidence from the Middle East among American Indian tribes, and that simply is not true. And there are other people who made the wild supposition that American Indians were descendants of either the Nephites or the Lamanites, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, and that's also not true, because we don't know the DNA that we do know that came from, you know, from my understanding and my research of having worked on DNA type stuff before in a professional career, is that we can't document how far it goes back. And
right.
There is evidence that they were here post 600 BC and post, the birth of Christ. And so it's hard to make that claim there to say that DNA actually did exist prior to, because the DNA technology just has not progressed. And it's been talked about we've talked about mitochondrial DNA and the genome for, since the late 80s, okay, that I've been aware of it, and actually have mapped some of my genealogy. I've had conversations with some of this stuff with Stephen Covey when he was in my branch in West Yellowstone, Montana, in 1991 and 92, when he used to come to my office, once a month.
Hey, good comments, Wayne. Thank you. Appreciate your call.
Thanks, Bill. Bye.
Russ, welcome. You're on K-Talk. We're almost out of time, so we'll need to make it brief.
Okay, just real quick. Like your guest was saying about the crossing between the Druze, which is a very relatively pure genetic group compared to the other peoples, there's a fascinating evidence showing a haplogroup X, which is mirrored in the Ohio River Valley.
Mm.
And if you look at Rod Meldrum's works, he's got a book called Rediscovering the Book of Mormon through DNA. He's got several series of DVDs. Really goes into some detail on the latest DNA research.
Yeah, my only reservation about some of those is the dating seems to be really early. But, you know, I just figured, look, we're still learning. We'll get this nailed down. So
it certainly isn't sealed off.
Right. Oh no,
the final word hasn't been put in.
Around a lot.
Yes. Well, like the copper deposits in the North Arm of Michigan was back and forth from the Near East for thousands of years.
Yeah. And there used to be a notion that that ancient sailors, for example, always hugged the coast. They never tried to go anywhere far away. Well, first of all, anybody who actually sails know that hugging the coast is one of the most dangerous things you can do. That's where the rocks and the reefs are.
Exactly.
So it turns out they actually got out and away much more than we used to think. And, you know, there are accounts of ancient Egyptians making it around the Horn of Africa or the Cape of Africa and things like that. People used to think they were lies, but we now know from the details, actually it seems likely they really did do this.
Good addition. Thank you very much,
Thank
Russ.
You.
Dan, what a great pleasure to have you. Thank you, sir.
It's been fun.
The time that you've given us.
It's been fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And next time you talk to Martin Tanner, ask him about this lake that he found on aerial maps and the narrow neck of land and the snakes that protect the area. I think you'll find it fascinating.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.